The human need for criminal justice system has been explained on the basis of man's humanity, his fundamental and unique distinction from the animal. At the same time, criminal justice systems are necessary precisely because this unique and fundamental humanity has been distorted and corrupted. Society considers only the failures and deviations of human beings to be crimes. It would be nonsense to speak of the crimes of elephants or mosquitoes, although trials of animals for alleged crimes were not uncommon until recent times. It is because we believe that man has options which enable him to make choices that we consider certain actions criminal. Because we consider adult human beings uniquely responsible and fundamentally different from the animal, we accuse them of crimes, try to establish the degree of their guilt, and punish them in various ways, from the imposition of fines to the withdrawal of rights, including the rights otherwise considered inalienable, namely life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. This entire approach to human behavior assumes a certain view of man which in our culture at least is rooted deeply in the biblical tradition. From the expulsion of Adam and Eve because they ate of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, to the vision of the book of Revelation, "Behold, I am coming soon, bringing my recompense to repay everyone for what he has done," the biblical view of man is informed by the notion of human responsibility. Indeed, the dramatic resolution of the tension between human guilt and divine mercy in the cross of Christ and the gospel of the forgiveness of sins assumes human responsibility, whether personal or collective, or a combination of both. The notions of innocence, guilt, atonement, and forgiveness are inextricably connected with the idea of justice and righteousness. Indeed, the legal language used by so much of Christian theology had the result of giving quasi-religious sanction to the procedures of criminal justice. The crisis in the criminal justice system of our time is to a large degree the result of the crisis in the credibility of the belief system which undergirds our kind of justice. It has been replaced in the Western and Eastern worlds by certain scientific ideologies which seem to deny the reality of personal guilt. Some assert that human behavior is entirely the result of conditioning, just as a badly trained dog may be sent for retraining to a school where he will be reconditioned by means of reward and punishment for further usefulness. So a badly conditioned human being is sent for reconditioning to an institution which will make him good, which here means socially useful or at least non-destructive. If the dog or the person should prove incorrigible, he would be destroyed. Because of certain prevailing traditions of the West exalting human life, it is possible, however, that in cultures affected by these traditions, the untrainable offender be placed in a mental hospital, since his inability to accept training makes him, by definition, legally insane. This attitude is clearly indicated by the treatment of Russian intellectuals with deviant political views in the Soviet Union. And it was tried in the United States when the distinguished American poet Ezra Pound was placed in a mental hospital because of his objectionable political views during World War II. In North America, however, the legal tradition has generally in the past made a distinction between the criminally insane and criminals. And the precise point of difference is the knowledge of good and evil. It is assumed that all those who are not criminally insane know the difference between right and wrong and are to some degree responsible for their actions. This is the so-called McNaughton rule, and it is being debated in every reputable college of law. In spite of the very serious problems which this assumption raises, the opposing view, which assumes complete environmental and or hereditary determination, is even more dehumanizing in its implications, since it obliterates the distinction between men and animals. Even Martin Luther, whose opposition to any human claims to freedom in man's relationship with God is well known, and who describes the human will as bound, does not side with the determinist when discussing human responsibility, and stresses the importance of the difference between men and the animals at this point. He grants all men a certain freedom in regard to the world, and insists that man lives simultaneously in two kingdoms. In one, he is guided by his own will and counsel and must make his way wisely and responsibly, quote, without rules and mandates from God, unquote, by Maharshi Kabir, 18672, if you are interested in looking it up. Here man rules and is Lord, though God supports him even in this realm, but without interfering with his freedom through specific laws. Indeed, Luther blames the papists for having taken this residual freedom away and establishing all kinds of human regulations with fraudulent divine sanctions where man should be free. By the way, Calvin does not take a substantially different view, although again here you would find somebody who everybody assumes does not believe in freedom. However, in his Institutes of the Christian Religion, section 2, book 2, section 13, he says, and I quote, since man is by nature a social animal, he tends through natural instinct to foster and preserve society. Consequently, we observe that there exists in all men's minds universal impressions of a certain civic fair dealing and order. Hence, no man is to be found who does not understand that every sort of human organization must be regulated by laws and who does not comprehend the principles of those laws. Hence arises that unvarying consent of all nations and of individual mortals with regard to laws, for their seeds have without teacher or lawgiver been implanted in all men. This is the same basic attitude. But while the biblical view of man, as interpreted by Christians through the centuries, seems in all its complexities to posit human responsibility and the reality of guilt and crime, the reliability of the human authorities which establish guilt and impose punishment is seen to be very questionable. From Joseph in Egypt to John the Baptist, God's spokesmen are frequently accused of crimes and found guilty by human authorities in spite of their innocence. Though the legitimacy of the distinction between good and evil is maintained, human judges are seen frequently unable to fulfill their high calling, as described by St. Paul in Romans 13, for government, a terror to crime has no terror for good behavior. It is symptomatic that the author of this positive evaluation of the power of government to punish crime was executed in spite of his good behavior by the very Roman government he so praised. Because sin is essentially alienation from God and the neighbor, it is not only the cause of all destructive behavior, but also the disruptive power which pervades all systems of government and justice. And because the perversion of the best is generally the worst, it is a perversion of justice which is the most profound threat to the entire system of law and government. It is in view of the pervasive complexity and ambiguity of the situation so far described that certain considerations are being offered for an improvement of criminal justice. Before discussing any specific questions, however, a preliminary consideration is in order. It is of the greatest importance to recognize the disproportion in the power and resources available to the forces of law and order on the one hand, and to the persons who are most frequently accused of crimes on the other. The prosecution has the entire prestige and wealth of the nation on its side, while the defendant is usually poor, ignorant, alienated, and despised. Thus the contest is very unequal, the elephant dancing among mice. And for this reason, restraints protecting the mice are more important than those protecting the elephant. Because of the biblical concern for the weak, the poor, the widow, and the fatherless, it is particularly important that Christians support all attempts to balance the scales. The efforts on the part of the United States Supreme Court to restrain the incredible power of the state by forcing it to obey rules are sound in view of the common experience of mankind of the corrupting effect of power. The situation in regard to what is commonly called organized crime is clearly different. The justified concern of the government to restrain its power is best directed against the causes rather than the symptoms. The application of all legitimate resources of the state to crush the power of organized crime is a protection of the poor and the weak, who are the most obvious and frequent victims of its pervasive and debilitating ascendancy. But if we now look at specific problems apparent in criminal justice as it operates in the United States today, it is obvious that some reasons for its malfunctioning are of a more formal nature. They are problems of design rather than content. Here belongs the overburdening of courts, first with cases which should not be considered crimes at all and could be settled through other procedures, and second, with cases which may have been considered crimes in a homogeneous, pre-pluralistic society, but which can hardly be so evaluated in the context of the present situation. While Christians and adherents of other religions in our society may consider certain behavior sinful in the light of their beliefs, it should not be considered criminal if it cannot be shown so without reference to specific religious convictions. Example, first, accidents which are the result of life in an urban industrial society should ordinarily be adjudicated administratively rather than through courts of law. Example, no-fault insurance. As you know, courts are overburdened with this whole accident business, automobile accident. From a Christian point of view, the actual healing of the injured and the support of his dependents when an accident has occurred, whoever was at fault, seem more urgent than at best dubious establishment of one party's guilt and the other party's innocence. I have those two words in quotation marks here. Secondly, gambling, drunkenness, the possession and private use of mind-altering drugs, sexual activities involving consenting adults carried on in private, pornography, prostitution, and other so-called crimes without victims may all be symptoms of serious ills in the society and genuine expressions of man's alienation from God and the neighbor, but should be curbed by the state if this is socially desirable through education and medical treatment rather than by means of the criminal code. Especially since unenforced and unenforceable laws cause people to disregard and despise all law, unenforceable laws which come from a different age and no longer command the support of the majority of citizens, should be deleted from the criminal code. Here belong, for example, those laws still in most state criminal codes which try to legitimate or to legislate the manner in which people may engage in their private sex life. A serious effort must be made to distinguish between sin and crime. The Christian community in particular should be slow to call every crime a sin and give up efforts to support its moral convictions about sin with penalties from the criminal code. For example, the unwillingness of many young men in our time to bear arms, or to be more accurate, to drop bombs on defenseless people, may be a crime, making them subject to incarceration in a federal penitentiary, but it could hardly be called a sin. To have sexual intercourse with a person whom one pays for this service may be a dehumanizing act for both participants and justly reproved by Christians and seen as a symptom of man's sin, but this should not motivate them to try to make such behavior a crime on the part of the woman involved and significantly not on the part of the man, as has generally been the case. Similarly, most arrests for public drunkenness are merely punitive and do not contribute to the desirable rehabilitation of the alcoholic. Indeed, the confusion of crime and sin has tended to make sin trivial and crime irrelevant, and thus detracted from faith as well as justice. Christians have seriously underestimated the power and pervasiveness of sin by believing that their ability to abstain from crime extricated them from the power of sin. The political community, on the other hand, has dabbled in the vain effort to make men moral while neglecting its legitimate responsibility to help and constrain men to act in a safe and responsible manner which would protect the rights of all. It is this latter tendency to use the state as an instrument for the promotion of the moral tenets of one group which has frequently meant that the social and legal reforms available for the reduction of crime have been neglected because of a fundamental confusion of the legitimate tasks of the religious and political communities. These sound effects, by the way, go wherever I speak. This is... This morning I impressed my Southern Baptist audience by having whatever I said accompanied by lightning and thunder. I think this is a tremendous, tremendous contribution to this presentation. It is indeed true that one cannot make men just by means of even the best laws and their strictest enforcement, but one can make men act safely and responsibly towards themselves and their neighbors by producing an environment in which such behavior is made relatively easy and rewarding. It is common knowledge that the most direct and effective way to traffic safety is by means of better roads and safer cars. to teach people to drive carefully on winding and obstructed roads is praiseworthy, but far less effective. Yet it is this latter approach which has been commonly used in criminal justice. This approach is particularly self-defeating when dealing with potential and actual criminals, since most of them are what the trade calls born losers, in comparison with those who do not come in conflict with the law. Since education has been a very negative experience for them, an approach which depends mainly upon traditional education to bring about their socialization seems singularly futile. What is needed is a system which will make it easy to be responsible and law-abiding. And Christians will only support such a system if they jettison the popular notion that the medicine which tastes worst is best, and that anything that is unpleasant is good for you. The Listerine syndrome. It is essential to mobilize the intelligence and imagination of society to discover ways of making responsible and law-abiding behavior rewarding, and thus remove the vast number of secondary crimes which make many of our communities so unsafe. One example must suffice. It is estimated that a heroin addict has to steal $100 worth of goods daily in order to support a moderate habit. If the heroin were administered through clinics with at least 150 outpatients each, the heroin plus administrative cost would total about $4 a day. Based on an estimate of 150,000 opiate addicts in the United States, the projected cost to the public in property theft would be $11 billion annually. This would compare with an estimated $450 million to provide a six-week inpatient treatment followed by aftercare for every opiate addict in the United States. All these statistics are not mine. I mean, this is what the people that have worked with this problem have come up with. Let me put it in very, very simple terms. Since the heroin addict is cheated when he tries to sell the color television set that he has hoisted somewhere, and he has to steal an incredible amount, and then he's cheated when he buys his heroin. There's an incredible amount of crime that he even doesn't want to commit, that is just part of the capitalist system, which is just part of a system in which in order to get his heroin has to play the game according to supply and demand. Society, by its obtuse moralistic attitude, encourages both secondary crime and an immensely profitable drug syndicate which promotes drug addiction. Even if very few addicts would be improved by dealing with them through drug rehabilitation clinics and making drugs available to them at cost, the damage to the vicious drug syndicate and the reduction in secondary crimes committed merely to feed the habit would seem to justify the approach. As you know, that's the British approach. In order to effect a major change in criminal justice as we know it today, society must accept changes in the design. But this can only be accomplished if some of the problems outlined and briefly illustrated above are faced honestly. The Christian community, which has been so influential in creating the ideology upholding the present system, could, in spite of its reduced influence in a pluralistic America, play an important part in bringing about the necessary changes. Christians could contribute much if they would help to clarify the distinction between crime and sin and restrain the religious groups from trying to enforce their special moral precepts as laws, and if they would insist at the same time that the political community furnish rational, and prudent explanations acceptable to all men of goodwill for the legal codes it establishes and enforces. Christians could contribute also by focusing attention on the social and communal causes of crime and helping to develop an attitude towards crime prevention which deals with the actual causes of crime rather than the symptom. But in all these efforts, the basic purpose of criminal justice must be constantly kept in mind, which is to protect all members of society, including the offender himself, from seriously harmful and dangerous conduct. Criminal justice systems are for Christians one manifestation of God's law in its political function, contributing to the preservation of human life and liberty in spite of the destructive and enslaving effects of sin. Such a system must first identify correctly and apprehend those who are accused of violating laws duly enacted by the body politic's properly chosen representatives according to a rational and equitable system of justice based on the rights of all men to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Now let me give you an illustration of how this is not done. There are people in America who make $1 million and pay not a penny income tax. And there are people in America who go to block and are misguided by claiming as an exemption something that is not an exemption. And underpay their tax by $250, and they're in serious trouble. Now, a law, a tax law which you can't understand, as you know. If you have gone through that lately, you know, a seminary education won't do anything for you there either. I mean, you have to have the beatific vision before you can understand precisely what's going on in this, with this stuff. It's just, it's really incredible. But it is this sort of thing, and this is just one example, this sort of thing that is going on all around, which makes the whole, the people that are caught in this, especially the people that are on the lower level of being caught in this, they feel that it's none of their thing, this is irrational, it makes no sense, it's stupid. It's a way of ripping off. And they feel that one good turn deserves another. Secondly, prosecute on behalf of the state and guarantee the adequate defense of those charged with criminal activity. Third, implement sanctions against convicted criminals by means of fines, suspended sentences, compensation to victims, probation, imprisonment, and parole. Let me talk a little bit more about one verse. The identification and apprehension of those accused of crimes demand methods of inquiry and procedures of apprehension which can easily come in conflict with the basic purpose of criminal justice, namely to protect all members of society from seriously harmful and dangerous conduct. In the history of mankind, the agents of absolute monarchies and the democratic agents, democratic in quotation marks, of the terror of the French Revolution, to the secret policemen and concentration camp guards of Stalinist Russia and Hitler Germany, have frequently been the true criminals of their time. Police terror is a popular weapon of all establishments. It starts harmlessly with the use of law enforcement agents for the surveillance of dissenters, the interrogation of newsmen and academics expressing views unpopular with those in power, and it may end with the absolute terror of the modern totalitarian state. It is for this reason of great importance to bring all those activities under the restraint of law and keep them open to public scrutiny. A secret police can hardly be considered a legitimate agent of law and order. Efforts to identify and apprehend criminals that involve agents of the government in illegal action, entrapment, may lead to an increase in convictions, but will generally do more harm than good to the entire structure of law and justice and to its credibility. The trial in Harrisburg recently did not enhance our respect for the criminal justice system in the United States. There may be fewer crimes committed in certain dictatorships in our time, but the price paid, treating all citizens as criminals and making the entire country into a top security prison, does not seem worth it. May I, as an aside, just mention an experience in Görlitz, German Democratic Republic, of a few years ago. I took a taxi, and the man said, "Where are you from?" I said, "From the United States. I'm an American." And he started a long and involved and vicious attack against the government of the German Democratic Republic. I tried to quiet him down and said, "Look here. You can't talk like that. They'll put you in jail." "Put me in jail? The whole damn country is in jail," he said. "Who's going to drive the taxi?" This is what my experience right there in Görlitz with this man who felt that that jail just did not hold any terror if you lived in a place where you had to be 65 until you got parole. Because it's true. If you're a woman and you're 60, you may leave. If you're a man, you have to be 65 before you can leave. And they call these trains where these old people, the Mummy Express, where these trains with these old people are allowed to leave the country. Now, you cannot. There's probably relatively less crime in the DDR than in the United States. But the price they pay for it just is too high. The notion that the end justifies the means is theologically unsound, even though advocated by certain so-called Christian ethicists, since it supports the use of specific and certain evil means for the hoped attainment of vague and uncertain good ends. Secondly, regarding the responsibility of bringing criminals to trial, it is not only important to make every effort to prosecute on behalf of all the people, those who have threatened their human rights by dangerous and harmful conduct, but it is equally important that the accused have every opportunity to demonstrate their innocence. Because of the disproportion of power between the government and the accused individual, it is in the interest of all people that the resources of the community be utilized for an adequate defense. To find innocent people guilty is as serious a threat to the structure of justice as a failure to restrain people are harmful and dangerous to society. Yet a disproportionate amount of public resources is used to prosecute rather than to defend the accused. This puts a heavy burden on the poor and those of moderate means who have no access to the expensive and brilliant private talent which guarantees fair treatment to the wealthy. But a criminal justice system which metes out full justice to the rich and only occasional justice to the poor tends to undermine all justice. The prevailing opinion that the justice available to people depends for its quality on the financial resources of the person involved must be changed in order to support the system and make it respected by all citizens. Thirdly, law without sanctions is empty and meaningless. Those who are guilty must receive appropriate punishment promptly if it is to deter, correct, and prevent future offenses. Justice long delayed is indeed justice denied. But punishment must be appropriate to the offender and the offense, and the tendency to punish crimes against persons more leniently than crimes against property should be reversed. Christians should take a leading part in this effort because of their relatively high evaluation of persons in comparison to property and their conviction that law was made for the sake of man and not man for the sake of law. But perhaps one of the important reforms necessary is the compensation of victims of crime. The entire Commonwealth must begin to share the burden which the prevalence of crime exacts from its direct victims. Thus, victims of crime of violence should be restored to health at public expense, and their dependents should be supported by the society whose breakdown was ultimately responsible for their suffering and loss. Victims of crimes against property should be reimbursed up to a reasonable maximum as an expression of the interdependence of all citizens and the realization of the unfairness of letting a few individuals carry the burdens which are the result of the failure of the community as a whole. Thus, we would share one another's burdens and distribute the very real cost of crime more equitably among all citizens. This is especially important in view of the fact that at present, a disproportionately greater share of the cost of crime is borne by those who live in the poorest areas of our cities and are most frequently victims of crimes against persons and property. But while criminal justice systems are for Christian theology a more or less adequate manifestation of the undergirding structure of divine law which maintains human life and culture, Christians are also personally involved in such systems as children of God, who so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. For God sent his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world might be saved through him, in case you never heard that. Having come under the spell of this message, Christians cannot be unaffected by it in their daily life, in society, and especially in their various contacts with the prevailing system of criminal justice. For Christians, love is active in justice, and justice must be seen in the light of the creative love of God, which makes it possible, and the pervasive and destructive sin of man, which makes it necessary. In our society, many participants in the system of criminal justice are in fact Christian. Judges, prosecutors, the defense attorney, members of the jury, witnesses and the defendant, police and staff in correctional institutions, all may be people who know about the love of God and are thus under the obligation to see their responsibility in the light of this divine love. As a result, they should see their various obligations within the system of criminal justice as opportunities to manifest their faith in a meaningful universe whose ultimate purpose is revealed in the cross and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and whose God is a God of love. In their participation in the diverse roles assigned to them, the reality of the cross should guide them against sentimentality, which ignores sin. The reality of the resurrection should guide them against despair, which ignores salvation. By constantly overcoming in their several callings the threat of sentimentality and despair, they may contribute to the humanization of the formidable and abstract system of criminal justice by constantly remembering and articulating that the conflicts to be resolved are not conflicts between good and evil, but the conflicts of fallible and sinful men who are members of one human race. In this effort, all participants in the criminal justice system, judges, prosecuting attorneys, defense attorneys, juries, witnesses, those who are found to be innocent and those who are found to be guilty, the authorities who operate the correctional institutions, the guards and the inmates, all of them, insofar as they claim to be Christians, must be constantly upheld and guided, supported and reproved by the whole people of God gathered around the Lord and obtaining a vision of a more just world from their encounter with the Christ who meets, strengthens, and guides them through word and sacrament. Believing in a Lord who has ruled out vengeance as a proper human motive for action, Romans 12, 14 to 21, they will use their influence to restrict the objectives of the criminal justice system to the protection of all members of society from seriously harmful and dangerous conduct. Christians will be guided here as elsewhere by the role Jesus chose for himself and his disciples. You know that those who are supposed to rule over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man also came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. In the context of the modern democratic society, such service means to become involved and to accept full responsibility for the proper operation and ongoing reform of the criminal justice system, even if such participation and efforts at reform should mean entanglement in the ambiguities of politics and give offense to those people inside and outside the churches who would like to restrict Christian concern to the affairs of the world to come. The task of the Christian is not the protection of his own moral perfection, but rather the service of God in the world and in the person of the neighbor. Such concern is bound to be controversial. In the face of this fact, Christians are comforted by the knowledge that being controversial is not the sin against the Holy Spirit. And they are strengthened as they remember that Jesus was not the least controversial figure in the Jerusalem of his time. In the light of the Christian's responsibility to God for the neighbor, the following functions of the criminal justice system deserve special attention. First, Christians must help to ensure that alleged offenders have adequate legal counsel and that due process is meticulously observed. Second, they must try to prevent acts of the governing authorities which are de facto punishment when an alleged offender's guilt or innocence has not yet been determined. Third, they must support every effort to utilize the negative sanctions imposed on convicted offenders as an opportunity to prepare them for a responsible role in society. Fourth, they must cooperate with those individuals and groups who are trying to create an environment in correctional institutions which develops a sense of responsibility and self-acceptance among prisoners. Because of their responsibility for the weak and defenseless given to them by their Lord, Christians must take special interest in the protection and rehabilitation of alleged and convicted offenders. The Christian Church, as a corporate body, and each individual Christian should make every effort to maintain the bonds of common humanity with alleged and convicted offenders, especially since their isolation and alienation from society is a major cause for their difficulties with the law and the main obstacle to their possible rehabilitation. Since Cain's denial of responsibility for his brother Abel and Peter's denial of his arrested Lord, Christians are aware of the great pressure to disclaim responsibility for our brothers, especially those who are in any kind of trouble with the law, especially if that predicament is caused by their own foolish or culpable acts, we feel justified in ignoring them in spite of our knowledge that our Lord identified himself with us, our own foolishness and culpability notwithstanding. But since Christians know that crime is not merely the action of isolated individuals, but rather the result of the common predicament of sinful man, in which all share responsibility, they should lead the way in breaking down the wall between people who are considered criminals by the law and those whom the law considers innocent. In the presence of the God, before whom they live and move and have their being, and who has forgiven them their sins, and made them heirs and fellow heirs with Christ, the distinctions between those before and those behind bars lose their absolute significance. And the common humanity at the foot of the cross brings the Christian responsibility for all men, especially the least of these Christ's brethren, into bold relief. As disciples of him who by his society was accused of receiving sinners and eating with them, Christians must show an equal concern for those who are considered harlots, publicans, and sinners by contemporary society. But they shall do this most faithfully if they do it without sentimentality, false rhetoric, and illusions concerning the innate goodness of man, using the intelligence God has given them to attack the causes of crime, relieve its victims, and insofar as this is humanly possible, restore the offender to useful and joyful participation in the unfinished tasks of the human race. I thank you.
Whether you know it or not, we did receive his manuscript ahead of time. As I read it, the first time I went through it rather rapidly, because I'm a very poor reader. But when I got done, all I could basically say concerning his presentation as well today, from my perspective of what I see, is that you've heard much of the truth of what I find, and we would like to say right on. Because this seems to be where a lot of things are today. All I can pick up with is mainly is the positive things that he had to say. I think today the Christian church in particular, as well as maybe other people in the world, is when he began to bring this distinction very much to the forefront between sin and crime. I think much of our people, or many of our people today in society, whether they belong to the church or not, still have a label of sin, and it's very closely tied together with crime. And we fail to make this distinction, which he brought out very clearly here today. And if you're able to work with the men and the women who, especially as we find them, more awaiting trial than Mr. Watts gets them after they've been convicted, you find oftentimes that you wonder why a person is in jail or what crime did they really commit. The harassment as well of the poor, and more harassment around, let's say, sin rather than some of the actual crimes that are going on. And then counterbalancing crime with, you know, what is crime and what is justice. He mentioned the millionaire and the tax. I like to refer to something a little bit more current, which is IT&T. Here again, the inequities and the imbalances that take place as far as much of our system right now is concerned. But then again, he throws much of this back, not necessarily upon the courts, although much of it has to be done there and also through legislative process. But he throws it back upon the responsible people, or let's say the Christian community, whose prime responsibility that it is to see to it that actual change does take place in today's world because of their prime concern of mankind, his total welfare. Whereas maybe much of the rest of the community can, you know, renege on some of these things, the Christian community cannot. Although he plugs the Christian community into the courts, into the legislative process, and so forth and so on, much as I did in my downtown ministry, which was stopped. I don't know whether you should continue to do this or not. But I think people also have to really become aware of maybe what their Christian responsibilities are to see their total life as this. Because I found many times, as stating what he stated, that many people will divorce their occupational life and these responsibilities from their Christian understanding, from their Christian beliefs, and let's say their hopes for eternity. So there's much work to be done, let's say, inside parishes and inside society, in order that these kind of things can even get more to the foreground. Because when you're dealing with criminals, even here, as far as the most part, the whole theology of forgiveness, or let's just simply say of Christ, seems to go completely by the wayside. These are almost unforgivable sins, especially when they happen to be public sins and the courts have dealt with them. It seems like maybe if God deals with your sin, it can be forgiven. But if man deals with your sins, these are unforgivable. And we find that the retribution that is demanded of man in our society is almost unable to bear, as maybe you noticed in the recidivism film next door, with no words. But the whole air of society carries these things. So I was, you know, very much helped by his presentation in at least these areas of the distinction between sin and crime and the responsibility and maybe even the fault of society that many of these things are going on, but then also highlighting the risk of change, the risk of change not for change's sake, but the risk of change because of my Christian convictions and my beliefs in Christ. And this, of course, many people don't want to tamper with, maybe because they don't understand it all. But this is about all I have to react to at this time. Unless I think there's something else on the way.
This is the first time that I've had the privilege of being a reactor doctor and having the privilege of having a presentation in advance, as Paul had said. I felt obliged to return the favor in case you want to take me up on it later on. I am so much impressed by Dr. Perrell's presentation that my initial impulse is to critique and react with, I agree, I disagree, I agree. At this point, that's 2 out of 3, and that's not bad. Whether what else I have to say really comes out that way, it remains to be seen. But since the doctor is an educated man and a thoughtful man as well, I know that he does not want me merely to do that. So I'm attempting to complement and supplement and question what he has said. I agree that man's unique and fundamental humanity has been distorted and corrupted. Recognizing that this complicates the task of man, dealing with man in a criminal justice system. In this system, we imperfectly accuse, try, and punish one another for crimes which change from time to time in their ability to affect us. We change, and our opinions change with us, as do the systems. Is it correct to say that we, in our changing criminal justice system, withdraw rights, including the rights otherwise considered inalienable, namely life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Consider the individual's denial or rejection of these rights by his actions against these same rights of other human beings. Have we really changed our opinions about tyranny? Is it not tyrannical to deny the individual the right to refuse and reject right, and to deny him that right by refusing to withdraw those very rights he has insisted he does not want? It might not sound Christian, but Christian it is to say that every man has the right to go to hell if he wants to. But when he wants to do so and initiates the desire with action, then to hell he must go. He cannot be offered the opportunity to abdicate his responsible position by charging others with taking from him rights which he threw away. I'm not claiming perfection for myself or for others in our decisions, however. I am sure we make mistakes. I agree with Dr. Farrell that the reliability of the human authorities which established guilt and imposed punishment is seen to be very questionable. This is part of a problem. It is not the questionable judgments which are sincerely made by fallible men that concerns me the most, however, but the out-and-out perversion of justice. And by perversion here, I mean the deliberate misuse of authorized power. The cause of all serious crime, sin, enters into our criminal justice system when the books are cleaned up by snap judgments of the indigent and deals are made in the interest of time. Most prison inmates with whom I have dealt have admitted their guilt of the crimes of which they were convicted, while inviting our system of criminal justice of fraudulent dealing by prosecutors with threats of large sentences if the case goes to a jury, dealing which the judge may and often does overlook in handing down stiffer sentences than promised. And these same inmates indict the system of cleaning the books with deals for pleas of guilty to a host of reported crimes, most of which they did not commit, in exchange for lighter sentences which the judge is under no commitment to give. And I've added on my paper here, Doctor, that the Old Testament Decalogue and the spirit of the law as given by Jesus are violated by this. Dr. Farrell mentions the unequal contest between the wealth of the nation and its poor defendants. It is true. It does not matter, however, whether or not the defendant is poor or rich. Contrary to our stated ideal, the defendant is presumed guilty until proven innocent and is obliged by taxation to sustain his guilt and by whatever other means he might have to establish his innocence. Even if a person were successful and rich enough to avoid the presumed guilt, he nevertheless is required to pay for both prosecution and defense. Dr. Farrell considers specific problems, including the overburdening of courts. He finds no argument from me that this is not a fact of serious proportions. Perhaps because he did not intend to exhaust the subject, he did not state several causes which are of interest to me. One of these is the practice of almost unlimited continuation of cases by either the accused or the prosecution for whatever reasons, among which are evident, I think, a desire of the accused to allow time to fog the memory of witnesses and to lessen public outrage, and a desire of the prosecution to keep the accused under acute observation, if not physical detention, when evidence is weak and scarce, with the added wish of each party that something might turn up to strengthen his case. Also, both parties might make a better deal if a stalemate were unresolved. Referring to cases which unnecessarily overburden the courts, Dr. Farrell suggests education and medical treatment to curb, quote, crimes without victims, unquote, such as gambling, drunkenness, drug addiction, sexual behavior involving consenting adults, pornography, prostitution, and other activity. A contradiction later arises when he states that teaching people is far less effective than changing conditions, with the illustration that the most direct and effective way to traffic safety is by means of better roads and safer cars rather than teaching people to drive carefully on winding and obstructive roads. He states that, and I quote, education has been a very negative experience for potential and actual criminals. And I agree. His recovery of consistency, I think, might well be his further statement that, quote, an approach which depends mainly upon traditional education to bring about their socialization seems singularly futile. By traditional education, I take it he is not questioning the teaching of the three R's, but rather the methods of teaching them, as well as teaching in the areas of social relationships. My experience with prison inmates have led me to conclude that the experiences and social environments of vast numbers of persons have been and are, though overwhelmingly different from those of most of our educators and lawmakers and law enforcers, that traditional education, traditional lawmaking, and traditional law enforcing miss the mark of what is needed. Innovation, therefore, not for the sake of mere change, but for the sake of meeting persons where they are, is definitely needed. I rush to add that it seems evident that our minorities by race or social standing, receive social promotions in our school systems and are often not given opportunities to reach their potentials. Perhaps one of our greatest evils is tradition, traditional education, traditional justice, and so forth. Jesus said something about man and his traditions in opposition to the Word of God. That's in Matthew, the 15th chapter, 6th verse, in case you want to write it down. Traditionally, drunks have been locked up overnight and, perhaps more often than not, fined the next morning. And I seem to recall a few such renderings as $30 or 30 days. Perhaps that, too, has been traditional. Whether or not this has been punitive is raised in issue. I heard about a city, and I honestly forget which city, but I heard about a city that campaigned briefly through its police department to, quote, take a drunk home, unquote, rather than to jail. It seems a loving act at first glance, and it should be so. No fine to work hardship on the family, and no 30 days to work hardship on the jail. But questions arise whether or not the family at home wants the drunk, regardless of the cost, because he might be a hazard to the family members' lives and limbs. And whether or not a drunk or his family can really see compassion in the act of placing him in a hospital ward as a sick person. Facing it squarely, we must admit that drunkenness is not viewed with the same degree of alarm in every community or culture. What are we trying to do? Whatever we are doing anyway. Dr. Farrell implies that we are trying to get men to act safely and responsibly toward themselves and their neighbors. He says we can do this only by producing an environment in which such behavior is made relatively easy and rewarding. He says we can do this. Can sinful man do this? Can he indeed compose and act and enforce laws which can produce such an environment? Dr. Farrell has stated, and I have agreed, both of us by observation and experience, I trust, that the reliability of the human authority, and that emphasis is mine, which established guilt and imposed punishment is seen to be very questionable. Can we really believe that other such caliber men can produce the environment that we need? May I treat one of Dr. Farrell's suggestions in the light of that last observation? The suggestion to provide heroin for addicts, to prevent secondary crimes, and to thereby dry up the profitable primary drug trade seems to be another way of treating symptoms rather than causes, rather than the other way around. It smacks of providing men for prostitutes or guaranteeing them a high minimum payoff in order to put the pimps out of business. But Dr. Farrell says the damage to the vicious drug syndicate and the reduction in secondary crimes committed merely to feed the habit would seem to justify the approach. He states further on in his presentation concerning secret police and entrapment that the notion that the end justifies the means is theologically unsound, since it supports the use of specific and certain evils for the hope attainment of vague and uncertain good ends. I note here, and this may be the Baptist in me, sure it is, that ending prohibition with all its alleged evils, while it has lessened bootlegging without ending it, has not aided the alcoholic, nor stopped the crimes and fatal and maiming accidents in our cities or countryside, which can be laid at the door of a chronic alcohol problem in our society. I take note, however, of Dr. Farrell's sincere desire to treat the addict, and I applaud his willingness to at least consider various actions. I know only a few bright, and maybe that's, and I'm sure that's my judgment, and only a few bright prison inmates who would support Dr. Farrell's suggestion. I think the majority of the sincere ones would recommend all-out war on the big men in drugs, and no less than fair treatment for the offender that is apprehended committing a crime in support of his habit. We're talking about a workable and just criminal justice system, of which everyone deplores the need, but which we have no intention of eliminating as long as we remain in our sins, as most of us seem to be doing. I implied earlier, in reacting to Dr. Farrell's mentioning of the unequal contest between the wealth of the nation and its poor defendants, that he and I are in agreement that it is in the interest of all people that the resources of the community be utilized for an adequate defense. I have listened enough to a goodly number of prison inmates to believe that many have committed other crimes while on bond in order to pay the cost of the earlier defense. In some instances, the second offense has been used by prosecutors as leverage to gain a confession of both crimes in a deal to serve both sentences concurrently, thus conveniently solving both crimes and having time served on both convictions, and the man has received no defense worthy of the name. I've been negligent and or unobservant to notice the tendency to punish crimes against persons more leniently than crimes against property, as Dr. Farrell states is the case. If this be so, I should guess that this is because of another tradition of ours, the tendency to believe that some people are more persons than are other people. Many crimes by minorities against minorities seem to be viewed with little concern. But a crime against the property of some really successful majority person is something else. I recall one black correctional superintendent calling for equal treatment from our courts in the form of severe sentencing of blacks for crimes against blacks rather than just for crimes against whites. A call is given by Dr. Farrell for all Christians to constantly uphold, guide, support, and reprove all the participants in the criminal justice system. Judges, prosecuting and defense attorneys, the innocent and the guilty, correctional institution authorities, the guards and the inmates, all of them insofar as they claim to be Christians. I say amen. And it would be well if we in positions of authority or responsibility were less suspicious of the accused and the convicted and should give more responsibility to them in whatever treatment of them is involved. No one has more at stake than they. And serious consideration must be given to the employing of the ex-offender in the treatment of offenders in such jobs as chaplains, caseworkers, other treatment staff, and custody staff. Hopefully these would be godly men, including the chaplains. Perhaps nothing is more important to me than this. And Dr. Farrell calls the Christians special attention to the creation of an environment in correctional institutions which develops a sense of responsibility and self-acceptance among prisoners. Nothing occupies more the minds of prison inmates that confide in me than the dehumanization they experience in prison, the lack of real responsibility in their own treatment, the lack of the assurance of real worth, the lack of hope that they will be redeemed. Nor has this not changed. Why has Christian America allowed this, as well as other injustices, to prevail? If there are, in fact, as Dr. Farrell has said, many Christians among the judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, juries, police, and correctional personnel, then why has the system of justice, the best in the world, we say, why has it been so unchristian? Is it not because men have been sold on churchianity, our churcholatry, and Christ has been unable to rule our human affairs because he has been excluded? I have no quarrel with the ideal system of criminal justice, which can be administered by Christians, as it has been briefly described by Dr. Farrell. I do have a quarrel with the suggestion that there are, in fact, many Christians in this country at all, especially in the criminal justice system. Thanks.
I want to thank the participants in this forum for their thoughtful consideration of what I have said, and I find it helpful, particularly the critical remarks. Perhaps I should say that I reject the notion of vengeance as a proper notion in the, as it seems to me that you suggest that that we are sort of involved in this revenge business, because vengeance is mine, says the Lord, I shall repay. And so just because I think I am very serious about the ultimate rejection that's possible, I don't think we have any business getting involved in God's ultimate justice. And so what we should do in this world is try to try to play God, but because we have such poor information for this, and the computers work well, and so I would say that I would like to remove all vengeance aspects from criminal justice and only have such actions as would contribute to the safety and of all people involved. So this is as far as your paragraph. It might not sound Christian, but Christian does not say that every man has the right to go to hell, and therefore, we should help him in this way by creating sort of a hellish situation in prison. I know you don't mean it, but that's the way it sometimes comes out. And this is the only, at this point, I think you're quite right and we agree on this, that justice, delayed is justice denied. And you claim that I'm not aware of this continuation business, but that's exhibit A of this forever postponing action for various and sundry reasons. And you've mentioned some very important aspects of that. I think it is just terrible how these things are dragged on and nobody gets a fair shake as a result. We do disagree, I think, most basically on this crimes without victims. I don't gamble and I'm no drunk, although I drink occasionally. I don't use drugs or any of this, but I cannot find that this kind of issue is the one that we could institutionally deal with as a nation. And therefore, I think particularly the kind of thing that happens where you have a policeman in a toilet looking over the transom to entrap homosexuals. Now, I think this is more dehumanizing for the policeman even than for the guy who engages in homosexual practices. I mean, this is so bad, all around so terrible, that I think, you know, that's how this one fellow in the Johnson administration was caught by this type of entrapment. And I think this is dehumanizing all around. I believe that the court should get, that there shouldn't be any laws telling people how to have sexual intercourse. I think that's their business. And various other things. And so at this point, I think our most substantive disagreement is that I do not believe that we have any evidence that with these crimes without victims, with the punishment of crimes without victims, we're making the situation for anybody better. But perhaps your very, very lucid and important comment is, what kind of a suggestion do I have, with my limited confidence in man's goodness, which I share with you, his ability to solve problems. How can I say, why don't we build a better system? Well, it's very limited, my confidence. But reason is the best thing we've got for this sort of thing. That means the only alternative to reason is unreason. And so I do think that certain things that are now totally unreasonable could be made more reasonable. Let me give you some very simple explanations. Having a lot of signs around against speeding in a town is one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is like some New Jersey towns, which I know, or William Jewell College, if you visited lately, where they have built bumps into the road. And if anybody goes any faster than the speed limit, he goes through the ceiling, through the roof of his car. This seems to me a reasonable way of reinforcing socially responsible behavior. You see, this is that you don't even, they don't even have a speed limit sign. They just have these things in the road, and that takes care of it. There are many ways like that. I think this business of having a device in a car which makes it impossible for drunks to start it. Where you have to push certain numbers which they're working on. Or I have a friend in engineering who believes that you can build a... When people have had too much alcohol, then they cannot see certain sequences. Like, in movies, you have to see these pictures in continuation. And you can't do that anymore. And you could have a sign that says, stop, which a drunk wouldn't see. And you have a policeman arrest every drunk who goes through the sign without having him kill anybody, you see? Because he couldn't see it, and that would automatically take care of it. I mean, we have all kinds of technological devices which enable us to do things more reasonably. But at the present, we don't use our engineering and our chemical and all these devices that we have, we don't use them. And so it seems to me that one of the major responsibilities we have is to use the intelligence the good Lord has given us, limited as it is, perverted as it is, use it to create a somewhat better system. That this system will still be in need of reform, I would be the first to agree with you, and that just as I believe that the Reformation must continue, I believe that the reform of criminal justice system is something that can never stop. It has to go on, continue.